Greetings, friends. Welcome to the 10 Laws podcast with East Forest. I'm the Forest. Nice to chat with you again. I'm coming to you from Maui. I'm at the Ram Dass retreat right now. You might hear a little background sound of some wonderful birds. I can literally hear someone in the condo next to me playing ukulele. I swear to God, that's happening. But you know me, I love a good field recording. I love some good ambient soundscapes. So I'm not going to filter them out. Here, can you hear it? There it is. So it's been an interesting, beautiful experience being here. There's been like energy coming up for me. There's been these massive waves that all the locals are telling me is just like unusually huge. You know, people coming out, locals, and they're filming them because they're smashing up, you know, way past the beach into the resorts. So the water is not even, the last few days, been swimmable, even though it's beautiful weather out. Like, it's not stormy, but there's this ferocious, kind of scary current and water right there. So I don't know, that's like kind of the presence on the ground. And then here at the retreat, you know, it's all this blissful energy and all this bhakti and everyone just, you know, getting into these ecstatic states. And the first few days that I was here, I was feeling really sad. I was having a hard time dropping in and feeling actually guilty about how I was feeling and having anxiety come up. And I know a lot of it had to do with that I was performing here on Saturday yesterday. Oftentimes, just sort of like the nature of live performance is you can get nervous, you can get tense, you can get anxious. That happens to me. You know, I kind of have a name for it, and I get this sort of pre-show anger, maybe. I don't know. I'm edgy. I absolutely admit that. And I know it, and I can see it coming, and I know what it is, but it's sort of like you're trying to keep a kettle that needs to boil at a specific time, and you're trying to keep it on simmer for a very long time beforehand because you don't want to lose the heat, but you want to maintain just the right amount of focus, you know, that heat, so that you can bring it to fruition, to that boil, exactly when you need to. And because your body is largely your instrument and performing is largely a mental game, certainly for me. I mean, there's a physical game of keeping your health, but 90% of it, 95% of it is a mental game. It's in your head. And so typically the antidote to it is to be in the heart, which is the same path of our walking our daily lives. But it is an unusual thing to have to step up and be in front of a crowd and present yourself in a vulnerable way. I was actually talking to Duncan Trussell, who's here, about this yesterday. And he's like, you know, it's just like for your body, it's like going into battle. It's sort of a war. And so, I mean, it's bringing up this stress response that's innately like in the history of our DNA. It feels just like that. And so stuff has been coming up, and I was actually, what was making it worse is that I was inside this container that was people full of bliss, and the contradiction of that is what made me feel guilty. And, you know, I was like right before the performance, maybe an hour before, and I'd set up, and I was just kind of waiting. I was in the lunch area, and someone came up to me, or was to Rod, and was asking about live streaming and like, where to put a tripod or something. And I couldn't believe it. I actually like snapped at them. I said something like, I don't want to know about these details right now, or something ridiculous. I felt like my body was at like a 9 and my mind is like screaming, what are you doing? And I felt terrible. I immediately apologized to her. I'm like, look, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're seeing my humanity. If anything, I feel like now she and I are closer, because it's like, you know, people see the truth of our humanity, which is the truth for all of us. And I just feel like I was really, really feeling this charge. And I was on stage about to perform, and I turned back and I was looking at the giant portrait of Maharaji on stage. And I just kind of expressed to Maharaji, to this portrait, hey, you know, look, I am feeling a lot of energy, and I'm sorry, and I feel shameful, and I'm sorry. And the message I received back was one of, you know, don't fight the river. You are the river. You are always held. And all the fear coming up in your mind is about assuming that the river is, you're not in the flow of it, that you have to control it, and that it doesn't have your best interests in mind. And therefore, all this anxiety is because you're trying to control these things you can't control. And the antidote to that is to trust in the river that you're in. Matter of fact, that you are the river, and let go into the trust and the love. And anytime those thoughts come up, almost like a mantra, as a form of meditation, even when it came up in the performance, like some little thought, I just go back to like, I am the river. I am the river. I am love. I am held. We are held. We are cared for. We are love. We are safe. You are safe. And that's been my process. And that's been part of my journey at this retreat, this Ram Dass retreat. So we did the performance. Of course, you know, it was beautiful. And it was fun to perform. And I did a more of a ceremony style concert and really used the music as a tool to drop people deep into an experiential state with these songs. And I mean, come on, could there be a better audience than this crowd? Is like meditators, super Ram Dass fans, and psychedelic heads. It's, you know, like me. So they're going to eat it up. And they're also, we've been here several days, so everyone's just super wide open and they're ready to just drop in. So I come up on the stage, lie down up here. Just let's do it. Let's drop in. So I really want to thank Love, Serve, Remember for giving me the opportunity again to be here and be part of this Sangha, this community, and to share a gift of a felt experience through music to drop in. Ram Dass is, of course, here. Every time I see him, and it seems like there's maybe 6 month chunks in between each time I've seen him. He's definitely frailer and physically, and he speaks less and less. And this time he's almost working just through silence. He's spoken just a tiny bit. And I did get a chance to drop in yesterday at dinner and present to him a gift of the vinyl, which was a big deal for me because when I was here the very first time in June 2018, I promised him. I said, Ram Dass, I'm going to put you on vinyl and I'm going to bring it back here for you and give it to you. And the last time I was here in the spring, the vinyl wasn't ready, it wasn't finished. And now it is. So I brought it and I gave it to him. And I'm like, look at this cool painting of yourself on the front. And we opened it up and like, look at you got all the lyrics in here of everything you said, and showed him the splatter pattern on the vinyls themselves. And of course, the beautiful painting by Elizabeth Hilton of Maharaji on the back. And he was thumbing through it. And just nice moment for me, kind of like a bookend. You know, because that's the other reason I was feeling bummed out, because I was sensing that this is an ending of sorts. It's you know, a bookend. It's the other side of the bookend of what began and what's sort of now ending. And by the end of the year here, the end of 2019, I'll be wrapping up production with the Ram Dass Project with all these remixes. It's wonderful remixes. We have two more coming until the end of the year. So yes, in the next couple weeks, there's two more. And on Tuesday, what day is Tuesday, depending on who you're listening to this, the 12th, maybe something like that, of December 2019, there's another video coming out. So David Altobelli originally envisioned three videos. There's the home, it goes into the next one, which is Soul Land, part two. And then there's a part three as well we're hoping to get out all within this month, 2019. And by the end of the month, all of the remixes, the reworks as we call them, will also be coming out on one album called the Ram Dass East Forest Reworks. So a lot still to come. And yes, it is a bookend of a completion, but it also feels like actually a beginning. And I spoke to this in the ceremony yesterday. I said, I'm realizing that we're loosening the grip and we're planting a seed into the ground. And as we release that seed, which is all this work, we need to now let it grow and have its own life and live in the world, as it will do for many generations, I hope. And I'm already watching and listening and hearing from people the stories of what this music is meaning to them and the kind of effect it's having in their lives, Ram Dass coming to life in this music. And it's incredible. It's there was just one quick story before we get into this awesome podcast with Slow Meadow, who just did the most recent rework that came out on December 6th, which is freaking incredible. Stunning muted piano and strings that he composed and brought in. So we get into some nice discussion about his work and that rework. But I hear stories while I'm here that I don't even know what I can do with them. You know, wonderful stories about someone with stage 4 cancer who had their first mushroom experience by using the Music for Mushrooms record and how it's really helped them come to terms with their death in a way that's alleviated anxiety. And it's something that like they're holding on to or using as a tool every day to remind themselves how everything's really okay. That's beyond me, to the point where it's like, I almost can't hold the enormity of what they're telling me because it is infinite and beyond me, that I have to just hear it, put it in my heart, and then release it. I heard another story of someone telling me that at the Hanuman temple, the Neem Karoli Baba temple in Taos, there are people there, I guess, for many years. This is the place where Ram Dass brought the Hanuman Murti originally 40 years ago. And I guess they were like devotees of Neem Karoli Baba and they never really understood Ram Dass or his teachings, or they didn't get it. And they heard some of the music from the Ram Dass record and finally said they were starting to understand Ram Dass as a teacher. I mean, that blew my mind. It's like, are you kidding me? That was the gateway. I had a vision of it reaching people who'd never heard of Ram Dass and never thought it would like connect people who already knew Ram Dass with his work in a new way. Or his hearing about the music being a vessel or a tool for people to reach parts of themselves in ways that have to do with death and life and trauma and addiction. I mean, fundamental core values of the soul or core experiences of the soul. So it's deeply humbling and to do my part and play my small role, which is really more about will and discipline, and to love myself through these processes as well. As stuff comes up for me as I've been telling you, and to know that we're all in the river. We all are the river, whether it's flowing into the ocean or the rain returning from the ocean back to the start of the river to start all over again. It's always at the same place, at all places at the same time, and it's all us. There's a screaming baby in the pool. Okay, let's get into this conversation with Matt Kidd, otherwise known as Slow Meadow. It's snowing here in Boise, Idaho. Are you down in Houston?
I am. It's not snowing.
Is it toasty? Nice and warm?
It's actually like one of like probably 10 days, I'd say, that it's pretty nice of the year.
It gets cold there, right? In the winter?
Yeah, like sort of South Texas cold. I mean, yeah, it feels, I don't know what it gets to. Like the lowest would be maybe, I mean, it depends on the year, of course, but like 50 on average or something. I don't know. I'd have to check.
That's not cold.
Yeah, no, it's not cold at all. I was just going to say maybe even 40, but it feels colder to me, first of all, because I'm not used to the cold.
And yes, you grew up in that area, right?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so you are a boy who grew up in the temperate to very warm environment.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you for lots of reasons, because One, of course, you did a rework of the Ram Dass project, which comes out on December 6th, I believe. And that's very exciting. So I did have just a few questions about sort of that actual work and your process with that. But I also have known about your work, and that's one of the reasons I reached out to see if you wanted to do this, because you kind of came up on my radar a few years ago, and we have a lot of crossover between the two of us and our music, I think. There's definitely some core something there that I'm always interested in exploring, like where it's coming from for you. And so, right, yeah, I'm just into like talking to other creative folks and learning about their process and, you know, whatever, just stuff like that.
Great, man. Well, I'm here for it.
Cool. Well, let's talk about that rework so we can kind of start sort of in a more narrow field before we go broad. You chose to rework the song You're a Guru.
Yes.
And we had some conversations about that. Yeah, like why that song, or why do you think it ended up with that one for you?
I think I remember the rhythm of his voice being the most captivating. I think it was between a few that struck me when I listened to the record. The one about death, and
right.
I can't remember at the top of my head what I think the ones that Hammock chose actually.
Yeah. I mean, with Dark Thoughts, I would gravitate towards that one myself if it was me.
Hammock
did that one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
No, they did that and Nature.
Oh yes.
And they were the first ones on board a long time ago because they know Tim, a manager.
Okay.
From way back. And so I guess it's a long time ago he had been in conversation with them, and I don't know if they offered or what, but they ended up doing two by their own choice. And then we just kind of held on to them until the album was released, which was like many months later, because we, you know, wanted to release them after that. So.
Oh, okay. I wasn't, yeah. For some reason, maybe I just forgot that they had done it a while back. But yeah, I think I'm trying to recall. I think Mark, when it might have been one of the first people that I had any real sort of conversations about Ram Dass with. He might have even, I'm sure I've heard the name throughout my life, but like,
no kidding.
Basically introduced me to him.
Oh, like, no shit. Wow.
Stuff. Like, I'm recalling, you know, I need to dive into my memory and maybe chat with him about it. Years ago when I met Mark, I think it was, maybe 2012 when I first met him, but. And sort of got to know him more in like 13 or something. So anyway, yeah, the sensibilities and like the sort of spiritual approach to life that Ram Dass has, but to my eye, not very tied to religion, just like sort of a deeper,
yes.
Yeah, you know, like particular religion, I would say, is how Mark is to me. And he's sort of been this voice of wisdom. So it's very, to me, it makes perfect sense that they did this project, you know?
Yeah. I mean, didn't you say when we were talking on email about sort of different tracks that could work for you, that you grew up in a pretty deep Christian background? And maybe I'm inferring this, but there was like some baggage there. And you're kind of unpacking that in a way now as you're in your 30s. And, you know, this song to me is sort of one of the trickiest in subject matter, in the sense that he's talking about a guru, which in the West is a very loaded word.
Yeah.
Right. And I noticed in your rework, you took out the phrase, I think he says like of God or something, like I can't remember the exact wording, but the word God.
God decides.
Took it out. Uh-huh.
He
there's a choice there for you, obviously.
Yeah. You know what's funny, man? It totally was not. It was a total accident.
You're unconscious.
I know. It could have. That's. I'm actually. You know, my manager Johnny pointed out to me. Like I don't know how it happened. It just like. I guess we can get into this a little more at some point.
Let's do
but
it.
Like
Wow, I love it. I think it's really interesting.
No, I was just gonna say it's sort of kind of touching on the sort of the process, the sort of like I guess technical / creative process is that I ran. The recording, that sort of dry recording that you sent me of his voice through a cassette tape. It's fun, and I wanted to mess with the pitch. I have this Tascam kind of 4-channel thing. And you can control the pitch, like just the speed of the tape. And right. I don't know, there's just, it felt like Ram Dass deserved to be put into something physical. Like,
that's cool. Yeah, it does have a gritty quality to it. I noticed that. I wasn't quite sure how you manipulated it.
Yeah.
Slow it down or speed it up?
It's pretty much the normal speed, but I kind of, in real time, so I recorded it, what you do in real time, of course, and then I played it back and recorded it back. It was a little silly sounding, I guess, maybe, but back onto the digital workstation. And while was the cassette deck was playing and the DAW was recording, I was just kind of messing with the pitch throughout. Cool. So the tape was like slowing down, but just sort of slightly. And then cassette naturally has like the high end gets tapered off and there's noise in there. Yeah. And it's charming to me. I like it.
There was, I don't know if you use Space Echoes at all. I don't. I would like to, but I heard Chiasmos, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Olafur Arnold's side project.
Yeah.
They were using 2 Space Echoes as sort of like sends to kind of in sort of like a stereo delay that they, as you hear a lot, where there's like little pitch variations, and it kind of gives a sense of character and depth and life to another layer in the song. So I think that's cool.
Yeah, I love that.
Take me back to this happy accident or whatever it was for you, of the word God, of God being removed from the song, the secular secularization.
Yeah. They're taking what God happened? Out of Ram Dass now. back to that. All I was going to say is I think that it happened in that process somehow. And I swear to you, I didn't mean to do it. It just didn't get on there. And it was weird because there's a gap it wasn't like I just stopped recording too soon or something because he says that and then there's a gap and then he says something else and everything else was fine. And then, so I did that thing. I sent sort of one of the versions before it was totally done to my manager and he was like, oh, that's great. You know, gave me some comments and stuff. And then he was like, oh, I noticed that you removed the God lyric or whatever you called it. It's like, did you mean to do that? And I was like, what? No, I didn't. Totally. So
yes, you did.
I didn't. I don't know how that happened. Maybe God didn't want it.
Well, it's, it's really interesting because what he's saying, that essentially your guru and guru, the sense of like, I think the derivation of the word has to do with one that brings light to shadow or dark, or sort of, illuminating obfuscation.
Okay.
And so what's cool is that, with or without the line about God, it still resonates what he's talking about. And he's talking about how it's like, his guru, what role that plays in his life, but he's also saying that you're a guru and sort of all this idea that like everything is guru in a way. Mm-hmm. So it's very philosophical and meta. And so there's just an interesting thing that happened with you because that I would think that word with your own past, I don't know. I mean, which has more charge for you, the word God or the word guru?
God for sure has just has had much more personal relevance.
Yes.
I have good and bad memories attached to God, the concept of God. There's, it's just, I'm sure pretty much everyone in the West is going to have that experience.
Definitely.
Guru is a little more of a, niche word. And I don't know if most people would dive into this level of like thinking about what it means,
No, but what I think is interesting is like what you're doing without even through an accident or however it happened. It's you're kind of like making, you're remixing the song through your own interpretation, through your own history, and it's making it in a way more universal.
Yeah.
You see? And I just think that's such an, of all the things to get cut out on by accident, that one makes it into this more universal message that's also in a way that is sort of your own, the way you resonate with it, which probably a lot of people would. A lot of people have that history.
Yeah. I think, to be clear, did we put it back in though? I thought for some reason
I noticed, and I thought it was an interesting choice, and I was like, okay, great. So as far as I know, it's not there.
Okay.
Unless you changed it in the last version or something.
I think I actually might have. I think maybe my manager was like worried, because I remember we didn't want to mess with like the order of Ram Dass's words, and I didn't want to. It was an accident. So it might actually be in there, which is totally okay with me, because like I said, it wasn't like the middle finger. No, this is actually super interesting. I don't know if
we'll have to go listen. I mean, once I heard it, my ears are so used to hearing it a certain way that it stuck out to me.
Absolutely.
And so I noticed that. And then I never like put the hat back on thinking like, oh, is it back in? Or I just thought it was a choice. So,
yeah. I think I'm okay with using the word God. I actually, I sort of I've been in sort of different phases, I guess, of spirituality and faith and everything. And I went from, grew up pretty, my parents like sort of came to the faith via the Catholic Church. Mm. But then they sort of dove into that, I don't know, I call it sort of the 90s, like charismatic thing. It was like, it's probably still going on, but it felt like it was like a thing for a moment in the 90s. We had these like revivals, and there was like, the Benny Hinn's of the world. He's like a faith healer guy.
Yes.
And I think that was one of the things that I think of as well. It was before the internet, so you couldn't really expose these people as easily or get the information out there. So it was just kind of easier, in my view. I don't mean to be super negative, but to get away with like some of the snake
there's
oil.
There's charlatans out there for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so my parents kind of got into that, and I was on board when I was little, and then when I was a teenager, I was like, oh, I don't know. Then I got more on board in sort of a different sort of church group that prayed in tongues and stuff, but weren't quite that far into like falling over during the service kind of thing. So in my early 20s. I don't know, it sort of, I guess that'd be a long story, but it through various events and disappointments and I would say revelations in a way, I kind of lost my faith slowly. And then I went into like a kind of Sam Harris atheist Dawkins type phase. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of epistemologically more or less kind of there, but I've softened quite a bit. I sort of view the word God as like you said it, I think just like a philosophical kind of concept. It's language.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it is, right?
Yeah.
It's a word representing something ineffable.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like that's as good as you could say it. And it's funny because, the Christian apologists say interesting things like, well, I mean, that's what scriptures say. The word was God. Word is with God. There's some interesting things to ponder on there that I'm like, I don't just say, that's bullshit, I think that it's like, oh, no, that's an interesting thing to think of, the word. Because God is language, in my head. So
that's fascinating. Yeah, God is language in your head. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I'm using language to try to describe.
Mm-hmm. No, I know. God, it's an interesting idea what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that ultimately, I guess, to sort of put on the atheist hat, like, God was sort of created via language from man in some sort of way, but it was a way of making sense of the world and both externally and internally, there's mystery everywhere, I think other religions don't use God. They might use like the Tao or something, sort of like something unifying.
Mm-hmm, they all seem like ways of bringing down in octaves or bringing down the frequency into something that's more tangible and physical and 3D, like language in a sense. And how do we take these broad ideas, these overarching overtones in a way, and bring them down into like what's the root frequency so that we can just distill it to people like, don't covet your neighbor's wife. Don't steal. Mm-hmm. Don't kill. Just do this. I mean, we forget the philosophy. When in truth, it's like that's just sort of like the marching orders or where the boots meet the ground. But everything else, just like there's every overtone to a sound. It's all there.
Yeah, like that.
You look around, it's everything, every damn thing is just part of creation. And it's just, I feel it in my bones. It's like, it's all just this thing that we're inside. And
yeah, man.
There is no escaping it. There's no out.
Yeah. there really isn't. I think that's well said. There is no sort of escaping it. Like if you call it God or if you call it something else, or I don't know, you might call it like, you know, you might go Carl Sagan and like it's the, you know, your, say words, phrases like you're stardust and like, you know, you came from simpler elements and like, I don't know, it is. It there starts to feel
that's freaking true, though. I mean, that's so crazy. That is like irrefutable that the atoms in our body originated from supernovas.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. I mean, and in some ways, the fact that not that we can see the stars, you just look up and you can see that, and that we can use telescopes to see further. We're just seeing things. And it's just showing us right there with our own eyes the vastness that's beyond anything you could ever even, you literally can't imagine. And hold in your head what it really is. And it's just right there in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a mystery. It's right there.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. It's not, it's a different kind of mystery. Yeah. I totally see what you're saying. It's also playing with like your sense of time and everything. Cause I mean, those stars are, some of them are probably burnt out. Like you're just catching the light from them. And it's just, yeah. I mean, it's just, you kind of, you can hurt your brain if you think about it too much, but if you sort of like just let, I don't know, there's a way of like allowing it to be somatic instead of intellectual. Like you can just feel that, like if that makes any sense, you know?
Well, that's a good, if I may, that's a good segue that I wanted to ask you about what we're talking about. There's a bit of a reflection of it in your music, maybe a lot. I mean, maybe I'm reaching too far, but I sense
reach.
And I hear, that's exactly what I sense is a reaching, a searching, a seeking. And there's an unrequitedness to it in the sense that that's exactly what there is when we seek and reach with our minds, like not the somatic way. Like it's always going to be unrequited because we're looking for like the pinpoint that you can't pinpoint. And do you feel that your music, where does that sort of the slowness, the gentle tension, the emotion, you know, can you connect those dots to where it's coming from for you?
Oh man.
Is it even conscious, or is that just like what you like to do? And
I think so. I mean, I think that it's hard, you know, it's probably worth noting that I'm always struggling with my ego whenever I'm working on music. I always feel like I'm trying to sort of prove something. So I mean, maybe this is a sidestep, but I mean, I'm sort of fighting like this desire to like, oh, I want to get better at composing strings. I want to prove something to myself, something. And then another part, and I let with this Ram Dass thing, I let the sounds sort of dictate. And I was just looking for a little more warmth, which is kind of why I was like, well, I'll pull out the cassette tape. I ran more stuff through the tape than just Ram Dass's voice. And I just would try something and ditch it if it felt like it. This isn't, I don't know, for lack of a better term, this isn't warm enough, you know? And then after that, I allowed the strings to go kind of high. So there was a little bit of tension. I feel like I'm just riffing here. I don't know if this is a unified thought.
No, but, I dig hearing like the process. I mean, you also mentioned something at the piano. You were running it through like guitar effects or something.
What did I do?
You said you might want to do that. It definitely obviously sounds affected, but I wasn't sure how.
Yeah, I played my own piano parts and I also ran yours through some guitar pedals. Yeah, I think, there's a, again, I guess it's on topic, but there's sort of modular synthesis has gotten sort of a lot more popular in the last, or regained popularity, I guess, in the last couple of years. And one of the cool things because of that, I'm not personally into modular. I love it. I just haven't dove into that world yet. But because of that, guitar pedal makers have started to do these nifty like splicer pedals and stuff that to me feel like they're a response to that sort of sound that's happening, you know, the modular splicing and
yeah.
the bleeps and bloops. So I think I ran stuff through like this, I think it's a Chase Bliss mood pedal that one cool. of my friends told me about. And it's like a splicer delay thing. And then I could go into more of that, but like, I felt like I wasn't composing as much as sound designing for a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because like the song, Ram Dass kind of says his piece and then there's this atmosphere that continues for a while, like, I don't know, three or four minutes, which is really cool. It kind of just goes into another space.
Yeah, that was...
I like that.
Thank you. That's kind of a product of... I couldn't decide. I think there was a sort of piano riff that in that part you're talking about that just pops up there and then the song sort of ends on it. And that was actually, for some reason, I heard it as a choir kind of sound in my head, but I didn't record any voices really. So I just played this melody in my head. I was like, I was going to sort of build a song around it, but it didn't, I don't know, for some reason it didn't feel right. But I still wanted to include it. So I just mm-hmm. gave it like a B section. I don't know, a second half.
Cool.
That was maybe just because he's not speaking there anymore for like, what is it, 3 minutes or something?
Yeah.
A sort of a space to think about it. You know, let his words maybe hopefully penetrate a little more, you know, to the listener. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. So I was introduced to your work through Hammock technically.
Okay.
But you have a pretty close connection, as you mentioned early on, with Mark and Hammock, mm-hmm. which is a duo. I'm not quite clear on like how that started or what that relationship is. Could you just say a little bit about how you guys connected? And 'cause I know they released some of your work on their label mm-hmm. that they started.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still on the Hammock Music label at the moment. We both, he also came from like Christian background and did Christian music, so we had connections from that. I was for most of my career or whatever was either like playing adjacent to or like in churches or with Christian artists kind of touring and stuff. And I mean, I played with some pop artists and like other like rock kind of stuff as well, but I was kind of, that was my bread and butter for a while. And because of that, we had a couple of mutual friends. Some friends here in Houston had written some songs with some people up in Nashville. And Mark is a songwriter, as well as the brilliant Mark that we all know him for. And he's written for lots of things, but he also had written in the Christian scene and the Catholic thing, which is a little different. But yeah, so we just had some mutual friends. And I got into Hammock probably 2007, I think, was whenever I first mm-hmm. listened to Kenotic and had kind of helped me with some anxiety. I remember a particular instance when I was on a flight having some anxiety. It wasn't really like I was scared of the flight. It was just life stuff and like mm-hmm. scared of the future, worried about things. And this track, Stars in the Rearview, sort of sent me into this, like, it was almost like it was a drug, like a benzo or something, like level of like, whoa, this is really doing something to my physio, like to my chemistry. I had several other sort of points of connection with Mark's music and then from that other ambient music. So I just really admired his work and him. And then I found out we had mutual friends. So I had reached out to him for, probably a good year before he finally responded. As you can imagine, Hammock's pretty popular. He gets lots of people wanting to get in touch with him.
So you just like emailed him?
Yeah, I think I just emailed him and then I would bug my friend. Hey, can you like maybe like say, I want to meet up with him. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, he responded. And then I don't know how soon it was, a couple of months or something. I was in Nashville because I was playing with this pop artist at the time. And I was in and out of there like between like his touring and stuff, just I would be off for like a couple of days in Nashville. I ended up meeting up with him and met with him in this brew house kind of bar place. And I was nervous as hell, but excuse me. But we connected pretty quickly because we found out we had the same sort of sensibilities about like faith and everything and doubt and all that. So worked out way better than I thought. I thought it would just be like a sort of good connection. It was like meeting a hero, but he turned out to be, I mean, truly, he's like an older brother or something. He's not that much older than me, but he's a mentor figure for sure, more than just musically.
But were you making music at that time that you could share with him? Or
right, yeah. I was making sort of post-rock kind of stuff under the name Aural okay. Method.
It was a solo project?
Yeah, it was me. I mean, I had lots of other musicians like help out, and then I hired them and stuff to play on it. But it was sort of my baby, you know? And it was like, in some ways similar to what I do now, but it was a lot more. Like it was drums, and it had big ascending post-rock builds and everything.
Yeah.
But it had some of the precursors of what you'd kind of hear from me now, you know, some string elements and everything. So a little bit of piano.
Cool.
So I showed that to him. Sorry, I didn't. Yeah. But I showed that to him, and he was like, oh, that's cool. But I had also been just diving into piano a little more. And then he thought you should explore that more. And that's kind of how the slow meadow thing over the next couple of years developed.
That's funny. I had a band many years ago, and I was just starting to do East Forest stuff. And I remember I played it for my bass player, and he's like, he says, never stop doing that. I was like, well, what about our band? And he's like, yeah, but stuff is really good.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, you guys obviously got a lot more connected, because then they started, obviously you did start making your own music, slow metal music, and they mm-hmm. really dug it, and then they wanted to get it out into the world, and so that relationship has continued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've, he's, and Andrew as well, have always been a voice in everything you hear, you know, it's especially in the first record, and they even played on it.
And, that's cool.
And sort of produced a couple of tracks a little more. And then mm-hmm. partially because I felt like, I don't know, again, maybe it's ego or something, but the last couple of records I've been like, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to intentionally not like put their name on it, you know, and the featuring Hammock type thing, because I don't know, I felt like it would be good to do my own thing for a bit. but they're still very sort of, and I think they kind of agreed with that, but I don't know, you could ask Mark. But they're still very involved. And like particularly like sort of Mark always has a very strong opinion about like the order of the tracks. And
I dig that.
It's a big deal to get that right. And I feel like particularly with instrumental music, ambient music. To me, I think that, but, he almost always like will find tracks to, I think all three albums he's been like, you should cut this one in half to one of them.
That's usually a good idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is like, that is, so he always talks about you should self edit, you know, learn how to edit your songs. Which there's a lot you could say about that, but yeah, I agree. Anyway, I'm just going to say he's been, and Andrew as well, like I said, been very involved in that, in the creative process.
Well, you sound like a pretty good guy to have in your corner and someone to bounce ideas off of. Because otherwise, are you largely making the music by yourself? I know you're pulling in musicians to play on stuff, but like, how do you see that dynamic of being a solo project? And do you find that satisfying? Or do you have like some secret weapons? Like, well, I'll get their opinion, or I give musicians a lot of freedom when they come into play. What's that like for you?
Yeah. I have secret weapons for sure. You know, the Hammock guys are some, my manager too. He's manager Johnny's, he's in a family of artists. His sister, Amy Pleasant is her name, and does brilliant art. And she's a painter, illustrator. Hope I'm not getting that wrong, but she's like a visual artist. Uses and her husband is too. Like, you know, they've featured in galleries around the States and elsewhere. So he has just a really strong sense of aesthetic. So he's a good voice. Also, the string players I use are pretty much all women now, and they just have really, really brilliant sort of a different touch. I mean, when they play, they're informing the music for sure. Particularly the violinist I use now, Ellen. She's a Berkeley grad from Tennessee who moved to Houston a couple of years ago, and she's really great at improvising because she plays a lot of country kind of swing music. But mm-hmm. she's, like I said, a Berkeley grad, so she has a sense for a lot of different styles, you know, and she can play some jazz and classical and sight reads really well. She also has perfect pitch, and she plays a 5-string violin, so it's like got the viola range as well.
Oh, nice.
So she's, yeah, especially on this latest record of mine, was really a secret weapon. That's a good phrase for it.
Yeah, I've got a couple of those. Unfortunately, they don't live here in Boise where I am now. They're all Portland people.
Oh, okay.
I went out to Portland and rented a studio for a day. It was like 8 a.m. to 2 a.m. and just had all these people come in that I knew to play. And boy, does it lift a project up. Mm-hmm. And you get those other voices and other ideas. And of course, you know, things happen on the spot that you wouldn't normally think about. I mean, I told you that on the You're a Guru song, Lucas Tenson, who plays the Gordello, mm-hmm. that's just someone I ran into playing a gig in a small town in Canada, and he made that instrument. And then later on, I just sent him some stuff that was in the key of that instrument. He played over it, and that's sort of what made the track
mm-hmm.
initially, was that interesting sounding, almost Middle Eastern cello-y thing.
Yeah.
The Gordello.
The Gordello. Did he make that word up?
Yeah, because it's a gourd.
He makes
koras as well, which are gourds. And so I guess he's decided to try to make a cello too.
I need to see a picture of this at some point.
Well, he's got a website. He sells these things. He's just a guy up there making koras and other interesting instruments. So let's see. I'm going to pull it up while we're talking.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's worth getting it right. And it's Lucas... I mean, if I remember, it was Tenson. I'm probably getting this wrong. But Gordello. And it's like outside Montreal or something like that, where he is. But it's an interesting sound.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I think even people, I mean, non-string players and whatever, would probably tell there's something different about that. I mean, it sounds like a cello, but not totally, you know. Maybe if it was distant enough, you might think, oh, it's just a cello, but it's definitely got a unique sound.
Well, I love that stuff where, you know, it's just like, it's like you said, it's a little different. And you're just, so maybe you don't know off the top what it is, but it just like when you ran him through a tape player, it just gives it, there's layers of character there, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think... Yeah, there's like something ineffable about that, maybe, like you said earlier.
Yeah.
It
is Lucas Tenson.
Tenson, okay.
And I'm sure it says here he's a multi-instrumentalist and so forth. I'm sure he's got a site. And he's in Waterloo, Kansas. There he is.
Waterloo, Kansas.
But it's not a quick website to pop to. But you can find him. And I'll put it in the show notes down there.
Yeah, cool.
For the link.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. It's a cool sound. I screwed with that sound quite a bit, actually. It's pretty different in my version. I ran it through the tape. I could probably like pull it up and play it. It's probably still on the cassette tape. But and then I did other sort of... I don't remember what I did to it, to be honest. I definitely slowed it down because it's this... My thing is in a different key.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's in the track, it's not very noticeable what it is. It's so manipulated. So yeah. I assumed it wasn't there, which is cool. You know, a lot of people, including mostly yourself, it seems like you kind of started fresh in a way.
You know, yeah.
Just kind of created a new track.
I deviated more than I originally planned on it. I went through several iterations pretty quickly, I guess. But one of the reasons I switched to, I don't remember the original key, but I switched to B flat was I had written this like piano piece sort of like a year. I didn't even know it at the time, but it was like, for some reason it popped in my head. Whenever I was, because I just sort of got his voice that you sent me, and I played it back on my phone, like just by itself. And I just sat at the piano, and that was how I started kind of whenever I was like beginning to compose or whatever. And for some reason, there's this one piano piece that kind of struck me as like, I don't know why this seems like it's working. And then I looked, I work late at night a lot. It's probably like 2 a.m. or something. And I went to bed, woke up the next day, and I realized like a year to the day I had written that piece.
That's very cool.
So, and I didn't even use like that piece per se. It just sort of was a springboard. I was going to use it. And then, like I said, I went through all these different iterations, but that was why I chose the key. And I allowed myself to just go with that. I was kind of trying to be, maybe this is like too conceptual, I don't know, but I was like thinking of the idea of being guided by a guru, like guided by something outside of me, you know?
Well, I'm glad you did, because yeah. I think that's a great way to approach that track. I mean, if you're going to be remixing a song about guru, you might as well say, I'm going to open myself a bit up to something larger than myself.
I mean, yeah. I mean, yeah. I wanted to just allow that to be the case, you know? And because sometimes I'll totally shut myself down and be like, oh, that's dumb, you know, that's like an excuse or something, you know, I feel like I'm being tricked by myself there. I'm lying to myself. And I think I hesitate because I believe some weird stuff that wasn't true and in fact harmful to me in the past because of religion, because of, yeah, I'd say bad religion, you know.
Yeah, you don't want to be taken advantage of. And that is the main baggage people have when they hear the word guru, is just that.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I don't want someone lying to me. I don't want someone, what if I'm being, you know, bamboozled here?
No one wants to be fooled, man.
No one does. And that's the main thing, because there are plenty of gurus out there who use that word for themselves, and then they go and they sleep with everybody, or they steal your money, or whatever. Because there's humanity in them, can't be overlooked in a lot of ways, or overtakes maybe, you know, their own message.
Yeah, I wonder if that word has actually just been tainted way too much, you know, and maybe because I feel like entertainment, like movies and stuff, will seize upon that, or I don't know, there'll be documentaries about exposing cults and stuff and people who call themselves gurus. So I think,
well, maybe, yeah,
perhaps it, that would.
It very much goes against the American mindset of personal freedom and happiness. And so the guru is sort of like the perfect kryptonite in a way for the American individual. You know, that's why it's not it didn't come up in our culture. It's from another culture.
Yeah.
And we're just adopting it because we're bereft spiritually. We're just looking for answers.
Yeah. And maybe that's why those that are less honest feel like it's a good way to take advantage of people, because it's not from our culture and it's exotic. And some people might just be struck by just that sort of thing, looking for something. They're dissatisfied with their current situation, whatever.
It's like when you bring guru to the West, you're essentially mixing religion and power with money. And that's always a bad, you know, I mean, we see that, you saw that, you were talking about before in the heyday of the 90s with Christianity and the Benny Hills and stuff. I mean, that's just money. And it corrupts. It corrupts.
Yeah.
It takes over your mind.
Yeah, it can. I'm sorry. You just said Benny Hill. Isn't that that British comedian?
Well, not Benny Hill.
sorry. Should I say this? Isn't that Benny Hill?
Very well, maybe. I'm, so I'm thinking like, who's the guy on TV Benny with Hinn. The big hair? Benny Hinn.
I don't know if that's who you're talking about. Benny Hinn is who I said earlier. He's like a faith healer that... I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. there's a lot of those kinds. I was talking about just a second ago, like not wanting to be fooled. And just as an example, I mean, I used to believe in sort of like actual demons that hated me and wanted to possess me and stuff. And it came from my teen years, my parents read this book called Turmoil in the Toy Box. And there was like a couple of editions of him, like some guy. And it like talked about how, you know, if you had toys in your house, it was allowing demons in and stuff. And gave examples like, pretty sure this is from that book, but like Cabbage Patch Kids had like demon names. Like they had like odd names, and that's because they were demon names. And if you get this, if this Cabbage Patch is in your house, you're going to get sick because that's the demon of infirmary or where. Infirmity, whatever Jesus. The word is. So I believe that stuff. And I had nightmares when I was a young adult. I'd wake up, like my throat was tight and chest and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, these feels like hands around my neck. There's demons choking me. I literally believe all this.
Cabbage Patch Kid. Yeah.
Yeah. That's sort of a separate, we didn't have Cabbage Patch Kids at this time. But I mean, those ideas were just sort of in my head. And I'd have these frequent enough for them to really sort of like mess with me at times, you know, nightmares and wake up, just weird stuff. And then like when I still lived with my parents, probably 17 or something, they would like anoint me with oil. And of course I'd feel better when they'd put their hands on me and comfort me, you know? And I was like, oh, that's God, you know, chasing the demons away. But I was just plagued by these things. And then, you know, it turns out I'm just having panic attacks, you know, mm-hmm. as anyone that sort of could sort of guess, you know, like the tightness in my chest, everything, all that stuff. I still struggle with that every once in a while. Not so much now. With panic, but I did like 2017 pretty bad. I couldn't sleep and stuff. And it was just, they would come in and out. And I feel like I sort of learned how to actually face them and cope with them via sort of therapy. I had some drugs for a bit, some pharmacological help for a bit. And, you know, sort of dealing with family of origin and all sorts of issues. And so to me, that's the contrast between actually sort of, you know, unpacking something, you know, that's like, some emotional baggage or whatever versus like wave a magic wand, essentially, you know, pray, right. Demons, you know, whatever.
I often feel that sort of the setup you have, you know, the playing field, so to speak, of your life, like the one you have, the one we all each have mm-hmm. is uniquely perfect for the journey you're on in the sense that like, there's probably a connection too between that anxiety you're feeling and why you're making the music you're making, like that form of creativity and how you're expressing it. It's a balm of mm-hmm. sorts, mm. You know, and that's part of your path. And so it's all like this web of connectivity and how that app becomes like a gift that you're giving to other people. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like tragic in some ways, but beautiful.
Yeah. It's tragic that we need it, you know? And, I feel like that is the type of people that will connect with the music, and you know, I'll get messages every once in a while. It's like the type that I feel is a very sincere, you know, voice of like, you know, thank you for your music, whatever. It's like, is saying that very often, you know, it's calming or, you know, whatever, you know, and, it feels like a weird flex, I guess to say, but it also feels jarring for me to get, because like sometimes it's a source of anxiety to create, you know, like right, I'm struggling course. With the ego and whatever. But so I'm almost can forget that in regard to my own music, you know.
It's the nature of creative process too, right? Like mm-hmm. it is by definition, or it always has an essence of struggle to it and friction. Otherwise, it wouldn't. I don't know. I feel like that's just par for the course, and. The more you do it, the more you just sort of watch that happen. It's like, yeah, there's going to be times where it feels really bad. There's going to be times where it feels great and ecstatic. And you just have these waves of in the process as you do it longer.
Yeah, I'll say this, doing this was less so because I think partially because I did it in like, I think 2 weeks. So much quicker than I do a lot of things. And I was really grateful. You know, I had some busy schedule, time constraints, all sorts of stuff, but it was really, really good in that sense. It felt like I was saying earlier, I felt like I was just going to let things that felt like they were coming from the outside guide it a little more. And that was really refreshing, you know? I felt like I was actually flexing a little less with this track, funny enough. I'm pretty happy with how it turned out. And it was very calming running Ram Dass's voice through the cassette and hearing it.
Yeah, that way. It does sound calming. I appreciate you doing it with the time constraints and Do you think that there's something in that process of working quickly and, as you put it, flexing less that you might take into future work? Or did that just feel like that was the moment in time?
No, I literally thought that I should learn from this, doing this track for sure. Or maybe just the next, I feel like I'm always sort of playing at my limit, which maybe that's all artists in some way.
What do you mean by that? Playing at your limit?
As far as Slow Meta goes, I've never made an album where I'm comfortable playing the piano parts. By any means, I'm always like sweating bullets if I have to play them in front of people. And I could go back and play. I mean, you can sort of see, I think, well, maybe not so much this third one. I don't know if you can tell. But anyway, to my ear, you can sort of see like, oh, he became a piano player in between these years, or at least the piano player he is now. The first album, I could play like block chords, and I just spent hours learning what I could on piano. But every time, like for example, we went to I recorded in this studio in El Paso from the second record, Costero, and so I was playing piano in like expensive studio with expensive mics and like 100-year-old piano, like with several ears listening, and it was just nerve-wracking to me. You know, I could go back and do that now comfortably, but it's like I wouldn't want to. I always feel like I need to be doing something that feels like I'm struggling. I don't know what that's about. I don't even know if I was conscious of that at the time.
Well, struggle is good. Sometimes that kind of pressure is good. Sometimes it's not. I mean, for me, that would be a hard environment to create from, but it might be an okay environment to perform in, which are different processes.
I think you're right. I'm not so sure how I feel about that whole thing. I think it was good ultimately. I mean, it was great. You know, there's some, I wish I could go back now. I was like, oh, I could do that so much better now, you know? I felt like I was, I don't know, always just pushing myself, in some kind of way. Maybe it isn't obvious in the music. I don't know if it would be, but, as opposed to, I know I just have some friends who do different styles of music or whatever that they're playing. The whole point is like, you should be not playing at your limit. Like you should be playing in your comfort zone. So it feels at ease. And I think there's a lot of merit to that, but so, yeah, I don't know. I guess
funny. I've never thought about that. I've always just sort of like, sometimes something wants to be played, and if you can, that's where it goes. And if you can't, probably won't go there. And I mean, in a lot of ways, the limitations of my own playing, the simplicity of it, is because that's what I'm capable of doing. But then that can become an asset, right? It's like painting with the colors you have, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I was going to tell you that for me, I've noticed that I appreciate not always being in some expensive studio, unless I'm there for a very specific task. Mm-hmm. But for the day-to-day creation, I need that sense of looseness and nonchalance. So I prefer like right now I'm working on setting up a studio here in Boise at my partner's place. That's like a new space. And I'm just trying to make it something that is, you know, professional, but casual for me to just kind of come and go, as opposed to like I'm going now across town to work or whatever. And is for you, do you just work at home? Like, do you have some instruments there that you try to track?
Yes.
Or what's the process like for you? Or do you have a dedication to that? Like using instruments? I mean, tape players, right? That's
The Tascam thing was acquired like a couple months ago. Most of my life, or most of my music life, I was a guitar player. So I have a couple of pretty nice guitars and like amps and stuff. And I'm just a sucker for like a real live tube amp, so I'll run stuff through that. And I have a collection, I'd say, of gear. And you know, things were pretty good, you know, the last couple of years. So I acquired some microphones and stuff. I have some pretty good ribbon mics and junk. Got a real piano last year, and so I built up a little space. Right now, we're renting a house that just has this converted garage. That's like the biggest room in the house. Good place to, you know, sprawl out and make a mess of and create in. So I've done that sort of intentionally. I wanted to at least try to work at home and have a place of a focus. I think that's the way I prefer to work. I'm kind of a lone wolf worker most of the time. And I do prefer that. Although I value, maybe I'm starting to feel like maybe I should work in real time. Like maybe the next record will be a live record. It's just thoughts that go through my head, you know, and I'll do it somewhere where there's like a risk reward kind of factor to it. But this whole year, this whole last year, yeah, I've been just countless hours, like playing a part, replaying a part, you know, running it through this effect, you know, that whatever, just months on just a few sounds, honestly. So I think that's good, but I don't know if it's sustainable, to be honest, man. I think I might work too long on things.
You said there was something you enjoyed about the deadline and the quickness of the process with this particular rework.
Yeah.
And that's your own guru speaking to you, that there's some medicine there of like, wow, that's exciting to you and interesting and maybe liberating.
Yeah, there you go. You're saying it.
Well, it's you saying it. So I'm just reflecting back what I'm hearing from you. So maybe that you opened yourself up to something bigger, and that's you, the guru, saying, here's the next step, is like, you know, speed it up and lighten up. There was an acting teacher I knew, and pretty much the only note he'd always give to people was faster and louder. And it just made them think less, and usually the scene would get better. You have to be louder.
Yeah, he didn't actually want faster and louder. It's just a use of language that evoked.
Yeah, quit thinking. It's like, go faster and yeah. Quit hiding, quit mumbling, just speak a little louder, make choices.
But you can't say quit thinking. That doesn't work.
No, but there's tricks. And you if I tell you, hey man, I need this by Friday, you're just like, all right, I got to start just making some choices. I don't have the luxury of months.
Yeah, no, that's, I will absolutely take that in, you know.
I was doing I was helping out another artist with the rework that's coming out hopefully all after yours. Just doing a few more before the year wraps up. And he wanted me to help. Everyone's process has been different. Like yours, you were just doing it and you just sort of delivered it, which was awesome. And we talked about it a bit, but he really wanted to talk about the process. And I would Skype in when he's in the studio. And then I was sort of helping him produce, and I'd sent him ideas. And then he ended up just sending me some stems. And he's like, okay, now you do stuff to it. I'm like, oh, okay. But I was traveling. I was in China. And did not have much time because we had a particular deadline that I was trying to meet. And dude, I had like maybe a day or two, and I was on the road in a different country. You know, Dropbox doesn't even work. I was talking to you too when I was there, and I couldn't get anything to work. But I think what came out of that was really cool. Like, I'm really, really pleased with the song. And there's something there about just flying with it. See to your pants and be like, I don't know, I'm just gonna roll with that for a bit. Now I'm gonna add some other stuff, and then maybe the next day you're like, that's actually kind of cool, you know. And that maybe that's something I would have like belabored for forever otherwise.
Yeah, that's, man, I'm glad to hear that. Can you say who the artist is, or that you keep that?
Well, we haven't announced. I'll tell you offline. I mean, it's not a big deal, but it's just like we haven't dotted all the T's and the I's. I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself if I start. You never know how these things work out. But
I had to ask, sorry.
The track is awesome.
Yeah, no, I'm excited about the whole project. So it'll be nice to be, I'll be sort of surprised about who else is involved, you know.
It's been a real blessing so far, and a really fun mix of people, how it's all worked out. It's funny because when it first was happening way, way, way back, I was reaching out to quite a wide breadth of people, and it would have made it a very different compilation of tracks because it was very much more diverse, maybe more electronic even. And it started to go in the contemporary classical direction naturally. And I was like, well, now that's an interesting idea. Like, that would be beautiful. I was not thinking, I don't know why originally I didn't think about like the idea that you could just do anything. Like, you don't need the stems really. You just need Ram Dass and just write a track to it. And why not, right? Mm. Or just do an acoustic version or whatever you want. And of course, it's just bringing in more voices. The whole point of this was to amplify Ram Dass's message to more people. Just that's it. And it's, as you said, it's a sort of secular, spiritual, universal message of connection, love, telling the truth. It's stuff that we really need these days. Mm-hmm. And so we do appreciate you putting your voice in the mix.
Yeah, thanks for including me. And so, like I said, it's been a it's been a dive, you know, into stuff that I probably needed to, I don't know, see in me or think about. And also just his words, I feel like I'll keep kind of stewing on them. I don't even know if I fully grasp the concept yet. If like I'm a guru, you know, like I can kind of say it, what I think it is, but I mean, I feel like I'm going to be thinking about it.
Well, it's another way of saying you're a god. And like you said, it's a word. And so it is an endless pit of pondering. And it's beautiful because there's no edge to it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the whole point. And music is a perfect way of dancing around it and describing it because it is metaphorical. And that's what I love about these things, these works and this project.
Yeah. I mean, I, for some reason, like the other word that came to my mind is just archetypes. Just like thinking, you were talking like at the very beginning about the concept of God, sort of, I'm trying to paraphrase here, keeping sort of almost like codifying like morality. That's what I thought of. Uh-huh. And I was just wondering why, like, we sort of need that to be embodied for some reason. Like we can have like a list of rules, but for some reason it really penetrates like the human spirit if it's like embodied somehow, like God. Like there's Jesus, the perfect sort of archetype, you know, and he was this way, he lived this way, you know. Or and we just have that in our lives, like mentors or people we admire. It's like we want to be this way because this person is. It's like we need something to mirror, and it has to be something like us, you know.
Well, we want to be inspired.
Yeah, if nothing
else. That's what art does too. What I like about it is it's inspiring you without it being embodied by an ego necessarily. It's embodying an idea or something that's blurry and that's contradictory even at times, or there's tension, because that's what life is, an incarnation is. It's blurry and gray and full of everything. And we just want to be inspired to say, like, how do I take the next step? And how do I get through this complicated dance that we call life? And there's no one way. And there's something about your choice, each of us making choices moment to moment, day to day, that's important. And I just think that's something we gloss over, that we kind of start to feel like victims. But no, you know, your choices do matter. And they do affect your life and other people's lives. And so it's like, choose.
Yeah, super important reminder. Yeah. It's easy to fall into that. Why am I not getting the attention? Like art, as an artist, especially, like I'm a victim of some sort, you know.
Right.
Why don't I get? And this journalist talk about me, whatever, you know. I think it's much more useful to sort of approach it the way you just said.
Well, the aphorisms usually have a lot of truth, and the grass is always greener. That's for sure. But whenever, I don't know when people are listening to this, but December 6th, 2019 is when this track will be available initially to the world. And you have lots of other music out there. You have a new record. It's called Happy Occident. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the latest one, yeah.
And what's the best way for folks to find you and your work?
You can look up my Instagram, just at Slow Meadow, or my Twitter and Facebook. Stream me on Spotify. I have a sort of like physical stuff, like vinyls and stuff, on Bandcamp. I'd say those are the best things. I do have a website, like slowmeadow.com, but I mean,
it's where you can see like tour dates and all that stuff.
I think that's live shows are certainly a possibility next year at some point. I mean, I just did one last night actually, but
cool.
So I do enjoy that. So hopefully that'll be in the books. We'll see.
Well, I'll put that link also in the show notes to your site or Instagram and so forth. And I appreciate you talking, and I'm just excited to, I'm sure we'll cross paths at some point too.
Yeah. I'd love to shake your hand at some point.
It will happen.
Give you a hug.
We are slow music troubadours. I'm sure we'll definitely be somewhere together at some point.
I'll make a pilgrimage to Boise.
Anytime.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Matt, for giving us your time. Man, check out his remix. I'm going to play it right here. It's in the background right now. But if you want to hear it in high fidelity and support the project, check it out on the Bandcamp, Apple Music, or eastforest.org, where you can purchase the record, of course. And please give this podcast a review right now. Just scroll down. If you're on Apple Podcasts, give it 5 stars, write a comment, say hello, info@eastforest.org, share it on your social media, join the mailing list, also at eastforest.org. Anything you can do to support is much appreciated. All right, you guys, keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. But when you do, keep the sand out of your toes. See you next time.
Everybody
do it with grace.
Has a guru. If you don't think you have a guru, I'll lend you mine. Thank you.